You're listening to the GamesIndustry.biz podcast. I'm Editor-in-Chief James Batchelor, and I'm joined this week by Managing Editor Brendan Sinclair. How tired are you this week, sir?
Oh, on a scale of 1 to 6, very tired.
Okay, well, 1 to 6 is an interesting scale there. I love that you've come up with your own, the Sinclair scale of tiredness.
Yeah, it changes depending on how tired I am.
Fair enough. We are also joined by News Editor Daniel Partis. How are you?
I'm good. I'm probably a pink on the 1 to 6 Brendan tiredness scale, I guess.
Okay, this scale is getting out of control already. Jeffrey Russo, staff writer of GamesIndustry.biz, where are you on the Brendan Sinclair scale of fatigue?
I'm actually not tired. I'm actually a little depressed, not in a bad way, because it's very gray outside because of rain. But other than that, I'm doing okay.
Okay, that sounds like that's an A or a high B on the scale of 1 to 6.
Can I just say that, like, we have the worst small talk?
We really do.
It is painful for me to go, and I'm sure the listeners are just, they, like, skip 20 seconds in right now. And
I might abandon this.
And just hit it.
So full disclosure, the point of the small talk was originally because we usually just barked our names in the intro, and then if someone didn't say anything for about 20 minutes, it would be like, oh, hang on, who was that again? I think we should just go back to that. Because it's a bit more on topic. Okay.
Yeah.
Fear not, listeners. This is the last small talk you will hear on the GamesIndustry.biz podcast. We are going to be talking about some of the biggest stories of the past week and the coming week. We're going to start with the past week. Mainly wanted to just have a brief note to talk on NFTs. Now, I think our feelings on NFTs have been very clearly stated in the past. If not, there will almost certainly be a link to the article in the show notes and the article that is attached to this podcast. But essentially, we are reluctant, nay, determined not to cover too many NFT pitches because the entire scene is environmentally destructive and financially dubious at the best, to put it mildly. But it's worth kind of addressing because it is earnings season, it's earnings week. A number of big companies released their financial results for either the last quarter or the first half of their fiscal year, and a number of them started talking about NFTs, so non-fungible tokens. They started talking about blockchains, they started talking about metaverses. If it was a buzzword, it was in those conference calls. Wanted to kind of talk about this purely to kind of re-gauge our feelings, but also kind of, I definitely want to point people to Rob Fahey's column this week. Rob Fahey's column this week is great. It's on the site, Baseless NFT Hype Hits a Crescendo, but Play to Earn is worth watching. I'm going to come back into that Play to Earn bit a bit later. But I particularly appreciated his point that, like, all of the execs who talked about this week, so Strauss Zelnick over at Take-Two, EA CEO Andrew Wilson, a lot of them kind of do it in a way that they mention NFT, and that gets investors really excited because that's the hit thing at the moment. And that hopefully, you know, helps the share price. But it's never anything more committal than, yeah, we're doing a bit of R&D into this. There are exceptions. Ubisoft is obviously throwing itself headfirst into blockchain and NFT. Square Enix launched an NFT collection or an NFT game last month and has said, right, well, we're out of proof of concept now. We're into full commercialization. We're going to really go for this and explore token economies. I'm going to pass to Brendan and Jeffrey because you guys covered these stories, the most nature of the industry that we're in. It's all very kind of US-based, so this usually happens on your shift. Your thoughts on why people are not getting excited about NFTs, but kind of name dropping it as much as they are.
So listening to the EA call, and listening to Andrew Wilson, he mentioned it as if it was more like a business bullet point. I can't think of a more eloquent way to explain that, where, like, you know, he's just explaining what they're doing. And he just kind of mentioned it. Well, you know, we're doing all this digital content. We see that's something that's out there. It's still kind of early for us to look into it. But, you know, yes, this is something we're going to look into. You know, he just mentioned it as if, okay, yeah, well, eventually we'll go down there, because it just makes sense from a business standpoint. And outside of that, and looking at other comments regarding NFTs, that just seems to be the type of energy that I'm getting regarding that, and there's not a lot of pushback regarding the downsides of them, but maybe Brendan can speak more to that point. But to me, that was the sentiment I was hearing and reading. Brendan?
Yeah, this is, I think Rob's column was right, and you're right there, Jeffrey, that this is, it's people wanting to hitch a ride on a trendy buzzword. kind of thing. And they aren't explaining what they're going to do with NFTs or how it will actually benefit people or how they're going to do something with NFTs that they couldn't already do. Because the big thing about an NFT is sort of scarcity in a digital realm, right? It's like, oh, here's a unique item, but it only exists on your computer and you own it. It's the same way that you might, you know, own a Babe Ruth baseball card or something and have that be valuable and impressive to other people. But the thing is, like, we can already do that. When you digitally distribute games with copyright protection, DRM and such, you're basically creating artificial scarcity, right? Like, we could, you know, copy the new Call of Duty a million times over and give it to everyone we want. And the cost for that would be pretty minimal compared to what is actually charged. But we limit that to make more money off of it. And that makes sense. What doesn't make sense to me is to have this digital collectible thing and then insist on, like, tying it to an environmentally destructive and grossly energy inefficient technology and a culture of just wild, baseless speculation, just knotted up with so many scams and legal issues. And it doesn't make sense to me for any publisher to, like, give up the control that they insist on having in a game, because that's the only thing that the blockchain advocates are really offering that is, like, theoretically something that you can't really do without the blockchain is when they're talking, like, oh, well, this way you'll be able to have the players vote on the, you know, this way you'll be able to have the players vote on changes to the balance of the game, and or they'll have an item and it can't be nerfed by the publishers. And it's like, okay, well, maybe that's possible, but it's only possible if the publishers set things up in such a way that they don't have that control over it, that they give that control to the players and to the people that actually own these NFTs. And that's, I don't think that's something that they are ever going to do. I don't think if they do that, that's going to have a positive effect on the games that they play for the vast majority of players. You know, a few people who own a bunch of NFTs might be happy at being able to have their way, but then the rest of the player base will pretty rapidly lose interest, I imagine. And I think, like, kind of bigger picture, this is just another in, like, a weird side effect of the pandemic, where people stopped spending discretionary income on things like going out to eat or concerts or travel, you know, things that they couldn't do any longer. And they just, you know, they had some money and they were stuck at home, and they kind of looked at investments and speculation. And you see the way things like the GameStop meme stock rally, things like Magic the Gathering and Pokemon cards suddenly becoming, like, big hot things again, the NFTs and blockchain and Bitcoin, cryptocurrency was, you know, has been kind of on a huge ride since the start of the pandemic. And it just seems like there's something going on that makes a whole lot of people really think, you know what, I'm just going to throw some of this money into the latest get rich quick scam, scheme, trend, whatever. And I don't think this is the one thing that makes me hopeful that it won't take root in games or in culture large generally, even though there are a lot of, you know, really wealthy people trying to give you the idea that this is an inevitability and that we're all heading there. This is the future, as Andrew Wilson said in the EA earnings call. I don't think it's necessarily the future, because it doesn't have that, like, fundamental value proposition for the end user. You know, Facebook's metaverse thing is going to be littered with blockchain NFT kind of stuff, and there's no there, you know. It's just like, hey, you can do everything that you do right now, but imagine just doing it with a headset on and in VR and paying us money to do it. And I don't think that's terribly appealing. And that's tangential, it might seem, but I do think a lot of the metaverse hype is also built on the blockchain hype. Because blockchain is a technology in desperate need of a viable use case. And there are some viable use cases, but not enough to support the speculation and the frenzy around it. And I think they looked at gaming and they kind of collectively said, like, okay, well, hey, maybe this kind of works here. If you look at it, like, wouldn't it be cool if you could, like, buy Mario and then put him in a different game? And oh no, people would pay for that. But it's, if the only interest in making this happen is coming from the people that would make the most money from it happening, I don't think you can will that into being. And I think that's largely what's been happening in the last couple of years.
One of the points I kept on coming back to in Rob's column and in general, like the conversation around Rob's column and the conversation around all these executives is, again, like the emphasizing the point that a lot of the vision that people have for NFTs, this pushing this whole idea of this vision of like a digital collectible economy, is something that can be done without NFTs. And like I've seen people say, oh, yeah, but imagine if you bought a character, one of you buys a character and that character's got slightly different stats to my version of that character. My version can hit faster, but not run as fast. And I've seen people like saying that sort of example. I don't understand how that is any different to what Pokemon has been doing since the mid-90s. Now, apologies, I may have said that on the previous podcast. I definitely feel like I've tweeted it, but I have yet to see a convincing argument as to how NFTs, these ideas of digital collectibles, is any different from trading your Pokemon, which, all right, is one of, however, you know, back then 151 characters, but has its own unique stats, unique, you know, different moves, different levels and stuff, like all the variables are different, but the actual character is the same. I do not understand how that worked. That worked absolutely fine without NFTs, blockchain, metaverse. All of these things didn't even exist when Pokemon was a hit. And yet now people are selling that idea, or one of, you know, this is one of the ideas as to how this can work. It's just not needed.
It's weird because loot boxes already kind of fundamentally do the same thing, right? And people don't get any kind of permanent ownership because they get to have the player in for a certain number of games and then they need another one, right?
Mm.
So game companies have been doing this and they've been doing it in a superior way that does not lose them control and earn so much more money.
You talk as well about how, yeah, another key thing that people, the key argument for you, the use of NFTs and blockchain in games is taking one item from one game and putting it in another. Now, we have said several times that the logistics of doing that, unless all those games, that item is being transferred from one EA game to another EA game, that is not going to happen. You're not going to be able to take your Dragon Age sword and use it in Assassin's Creed. Logistically, that's not going to happen. Companies are not going to collaborate that much, or at least they're not going to open up their ecosystems that much. But also, if you want to do that to an extent, you have modding. That's how we've got Thomas the Tank Engine in every Bethesda game and most other games imaginable, because someone will mod it in. It's not something that companies sell. It's probably not something that companies actively encourage, but it is possible. That is something that we already have, and they are doing that without NFT, without blockchain.
Yeah, but no one's making a ridiculous amount of money off it.
Nah, and that's the problem, isn't it?
Actually, they are making money off it, because I think the mod scene has been hugely beneficial to Skyrim, and Bethesda has said as much. But it's a lot harder to figure out how much of a benefit you have received. Like, you can't put a dollar figure on it as readily and as easily and undeniably as if you're actually just, you know, selling, you know, FIFA Ultimate Team packs or whatnot.
Okay, we will inevitably come back to this nonsense at some other point, hopefully a point much, much further in time. It's certainly not something that's going away. It remains to be seen whether or not people wake up to the actual realities of and the implications of this. If you haven't, please do go read Rob's column. Team, let's talk about video games. So, wanted to have a bit of a fun one this week. On November 11th, which, if all goes well, is a couple of days after this podcast comes out, we have two big releases that are actually two really old releases. We have got the 10th anniversary edition of Skyrim, because why would there not be a version of Skyrim on this new generation of consoles? And of course, we have the GTA trilogy, so GTA 3, Vice City, and San Andreas, because they seem to forget that there was a trilogy before that, GTA London and GTA 2. And I find it interesting. Like, Chris has been saying this for a while. Chris, our head of games B2B, who is not here because he's too busy out working. A lot of releases, for several years, obviously, but this year in particular, a lot of the highly anticipated releases are re-releases or remakes. And this is like quite literal re-releases. You've got, I know they've upped the graphics slightly and they've tweaked the controls, but it's not like a massive overhaul. It's not like a Resident Evil style remake. GTA will just be GTA. Skyrim will be Skyrim, albeit with some extra quests. And yet, these are hotly anticipated releases, even among our team. I know that some of us are fully intending to buy these, despite the fact that we have owned these several times. At which point, I turned to Danielle and asked, when did you first realise you had a Skyrim problem?
So yeah, we discussed this earlier in the week, but I'll incriminate myself again. But this will be my fourth time buying Skyrim, I think. I bought it on the 360 at launch, I bought it on the Xbox One. I built a gaming PC a few years ago and then bought it on PC because everybody told me that it was better on PC. And I recently bought it on the PS5, so I can treat myself to sitting a few meters away on the couch and playing Skyrim instead of playing it on consoles that I've played it on before. And I don't know what it is about this game that keeps me coming back to it, because it's not like there's things left in Skyrim that I can rediscover, but there's just something really comforting about returning to those landscapes that you just wasted so much time in, even though you know what's coming, you know what happens, but it's, I don't know, maybe it was just, it sort of came out in a formative time in my life and it kind of reminds me of that time, but then the GTA collection came out at a completely different time and I still feel that way about it. Nostalgia is just a really powerful tool, isn't it? And it's a tool that everybody will capitalize on if they get an opportunity to.
So you say about, like, there's a not much for you to rediscover. Like, so I have owned this twice. I bought it on 360 back in the day. I then bought it on Switch because the idea of portable Skyrim is something portable Elder Scrolls is something I've been excited about since I remember they promised they were making a version of Oblivion for the PSP. And it's wonderful on Switch. I mean, it's not like overly technically impressive, but being able to play Skyrim on the train is just, there's a novelty I've still not got over. And I think I put a good 50-60 hours into the 360 version. I've put about 40 hours into the Switch version, and I have not done a single quest. I've not rediscovered, like, the same thing. Obviously, you do, like, the intro, but apart from that, everything I've done has been completely different. I've found areas that I didn't know about. And part of that is obviously, like, the DLC, because I didn't have the DLC back in the day, but genuinely, like, there are stuff in the base game. Like, I found, like, there's a side quest that takes you to, like, an underground grove with a massive tree that looks like the one out of Avatar or something. It's a comfort game. It's definitely a comfort game. It's the sort of one that you can just dip in and out of, and there's, like, a ridiculous amount to it. And I kind of like that it keeps selling. I kind of like that they keep really releasing it because, yeah, cynically you can say, yeah, they're just getting you to buy the same game over and over again. They're milking. I mean, how much? Think if you, at the risk of making you think about it, Danielle, how much have you spent on the same game? How many times have you? I'm assuming you didn't buy it full price every time.
No, I think only time that I did buy it full price will have been on the launch.
Will have been launch.
Yeah.
Right, but even if you've bought, say, a tenner each time, that's like, you know, 30, 40 quid more, you know, 20, 30 quid more than they would have got out of you had you just bought the one version. So there is the element of they are doing this because they know they can sell it to you again and they will get more money from the same customer. But equally, I don't know, if we enjoy it, what's the harm? You know, I know this is the justification we give ourselves for buying the same Nintendo games over and over again.
I don't think it's as exploitative as somebody spending 40 quid on loot boxes or FIFA packs or whatever people choose to spend their money on. At least you're putting another 40 quid into hours and hours of content that you know and love, and that's fine. And I think it's interesting as well, because it's been a joke for a long time that Skyrim will come out on anything that you can plug into a wall, but it's the 10th anniversary of such a huge revered title, and it's not weird for them to do a 10th anniversary celebration. A lot of franchises do that anyway.
It's the biggest game they've done. It's by far the biggest in the series. It's by far one of the biggest, if not the biggest, that Bethesda has ever released. So yeah, like celebrating that accomplishment is definitely worth doing. You joke, you say about like releasing it everything that into everything that plugs into a wall. I will at this point confess, I have played the Alexa version. And I think I got a good half an hour, 45 minutes into it before I realised this is just an endless string of randomly generated quests, and they occasionally tell you your number has, your level number has gone up. But hey, that was a fun 45 minutes.
I need to try that, actually. I keep meaning to, but I haven't yet, and I'm not going to say the word because she's behind me.
I'm safely away from her. Brendan and Jeffrey, you're remaining remarkably quiet. Is Skyrim one that passed you by?
I bought it twice. I got it on the 360 shortly after launch, and I kind of bounced off it. I got it on Switch, and I played it a bit more, and I liked it, but like I got way into Morrowind when it came out, and I kind of quickly hit the point where Skyrim just sort of felt like, you know, more of that, which is weird, because, you know, if I go back and play Morrowind, I'm sure I would see a billion different ways that Skyrim is just sort of a smoother, more polished, user-friendly experience. But honestly, you know, some of the jankiness of Morrowind was endearing. Yeah, there was even if it like crashed every half hour on average when I was playing it on the original Xbox, that became part of the appeal. It's like, how far can you get before it just dies on you again? It's weird to say that's part of the appeal, but I get rebuying old games. I find the appeal usually a lot stronger when the game has been functionally unavailable and unplayable for a longer period of time. So like a lot of the stuff that I'm picking up on the Switch lately has been like old Genesis or arcade games that haven't been re-released a million times and haven't been kind of, you know, relevant in a modern gaming sense since their original release. And yeah, I've had a lot of fun with those, even though, you know, some of them I, you know, kind of know like the back of my hand, and others it's just, hey, I always heard that was good and let's try it for the first time. And that's, you know, the both of those audiences get something out of a re-release, those that loved the original and those that only knew it by reputation. So I'm not, you know, I'm never bothered, I guess, by the re-releases. I think the Skyrim one is sort of, it's surprising that it can keep selling, but I mean, Grand Theft Auto 5 has 155 million copies shipped lifetime now, and it's the big new release from Take-Two next year. So.
Yeah, exactly. This is what makes me laugh. Like the, you know, GTA 5 is obviously the prime example of this, because like it's not old. It's not. It's less than 10 years. It's younger than Skyrim, and yet, yeah, you're right. It's like it's one of the biggest, most anticipated releases of next year, or not just among consumers, but among like analysts. Like, you know, Global Sales Data did a talk at GI Live London, looking at the kind of the effect of pandemic on both boxed and download full game sales, and they were talking about like, you know, the really big impact is the delays and the lack of new releases in 2021 really kind of not necessarily shrunk the market, but certainly limited its growth. And they listed GTA 5 as one of the massive releases they expect to really, you know, move the needle in 2022. And that's just utterly ridiculous. But also, why not? It's doing well. So sure. I mean, similarly, like I kind of, it was a couple of weeks back when CD Projekt Red released their financials, and they announced that they were delaying the Cyberpunk DLC and the Cyberpunk next gen release and The Witcher 3 next-gen release. And the most headlines I saw were about The Witcher 3. Witcher 3 next-gen release, like, delayed. That game is from 2015. Most people, not most, but like a lot of people have played that game and played it to death. Not everyone, because I am finally playing it myself. But like, it just made me laugh that out of the two, like Cyberpunk, this really long, long-awaited game that came out last year and was disappointing because of the state of it, but there was always that underlying promise of maybe the next-gen version will be vaguely playable and therefore what everyone has been waiting for. And you'd think that's what a lot of people are waiting for. I have a copy of Cyberpunk. I am waiting for that next-gen release before I even attempt to install it. But no, the media were more... The media and, by extension, like, they knew their audience would be more excited about the fact that Witcher 3 is coming out next year.
What's always fascinating to me is... When you were speaking about Skyrim, that's something that passed me by. I just never got around to it, and I always end up just watching others play it. And it's always interesting to see when you don't play something, to just see how people respond to it. And, you know, with the releases of, you know, Witcher 3, whenever that's going to come out again, and even the Grand Theft Auto collection, it's to me, it's fascinating to see how people respond to something now versus however many years ago. There might be new things for you to notice or things you might hate, you know. That's why I always find re-releases interesting in that way, where maybe you were, you know, in grade school or whatever the case may have been. Now that you're adult, there's certain things that may not click, or, you know, there's underpinnings in a game that you realize, oh, I didn't realize that was there, but that was there in your face the entire time. I always find it interesting. Speaking more broadly about Grand Theft Auto 5, I don't know how much more about that game people are finding out as it keeps constantly being re-released, but, you know, people are still playing it, and the online version, so, you know, that kind of speaks for itself.
That's the thing, is the online version. Like, GTA 5... Skyrim hasn't really changed. They'd have added a few more quests to the 10th anniversary version, and that, I think there's probably some like quality of life improvements and so forth. But by and large, that game is the same. The GTA trilogy that's coming out, you know, like GTA 3, Vice City, San Andreas, those will be the same. GTA 5 is not the same game as it was when it released in 2013 because the ongoing updates to the online version. Yeah, the single player game, that stays the same. But at this stage, it is the online version. We can see this from Take-Two's financials. It's the online version that's driving it. And I swear, every week we're getting a press release like new expansion, new quests, new event, new heist, new like... That game has become an evolving game, just GTA Online. Like, and I've not delved into it too deeply, but when I've played like a few hours of it, and the way it's structured, it feels like a GTA game in that, you know, you've got cutscenes and missions and stuff to do. So it feels like, it almost feels like GTA 6, I guess, or GTA 5.2, as it were, like whatever the Vice City equivalent to GTA 5 would have been. Like, so yeah, that game, I can see that game still going because, yeah, like it constantly is changing. I don't know where they're finding more people. I don't know where they're finding more people that by this point have not bought GTA 5 because... Yeah, like as big as the online version is going, you would think most online games, to an extent, their growth slows to the point where like they're mostly catering to like the avid loyal audience that want more content, and that's who the expansions are for. And yet, you know, the sheer number of copies that GTA 5, either people are losing a lot of GTA 5 discs, or just desperately like buying different versions on different consoles, or yeah, I just do not understand how they're tapping into new audiences. It's amazing.
So. GTA 5, like the online thing is obviously a huge part of it and its enduring appeal. But like Skyrim, it also has a pretty healthy mod scene from what I understand. Mm. And I think mod scenes are tremendous for keeping a community of people interested in the game over a longer period of time, and for giving them something to come back to the game for. Again and again. I don't know how much of the success of GTA 5 can really be attributed to that, or if it's had as big an impact on the game as Skyrim's mods had on that game. It's still something that I think bears mentioning in addition to the live service component.
That's true. I always wonder how big the modding scene is, though, because modding is primarily... No, it is only available on PC. You can't really mod the Xbox or the PlayStation versions, which depends on your market, I grant you, but certainly here in the UK, the console scene is bigger than the PC scene. So, yeah, mods are an element, and certain mods are probably certainly driving the PC sales and the PC community. But, the fact that always amazes me, you can't get it on consoles at this point, but I think it's the stability. Like Microsoft and Sony are still worried about the stability. But also, like, the viral nature of it as well. Like, the And that, this ties in with the mods as well. Like the YouTube algorithm has attempted to direct my children towards videos of like their videos recorded in GTA 5, but it's like Spider-Man and the Paw Patrol and insert popular children's character here driving like the A-Team van and the Mystery Machine and all these different like and they're basically having contests as to who can do this, you know, do the best stunts on this massive jump. That, oh, by the way, someone has also modded that in as well. Like. So it's the viral nature. Like GTA 5 gets a lot of attention, even if you're not playing GTA 5.
Yeah, the role playing aspects of the live game is it's really entertaining for people and to watch. I'll be honest, there are times where I'll just sit back and watch. I'm like, oh wow, this is hilarious. But there was something that Daniel mentioned earlier, speaking about Skyrim, that I wanted to mention was there. Also, when it comes back to re-releases, I know we haven't talked about the Grand Theft Auto trilogy yet, but there's something to be said, I guess, for that feeling of familiarity, you know, where your endorphins are just running. It's like, oh, I remember this. This was a good time because, you know, let's be honest, things might suck and it benefits you to just, you know, turn on a game. And just enjoy your time. And not to point out or single out James, I'm sorry, but I remember I saw a tweet from James. He said something to the effect of, I forget what game it is, I'm so sorry, but you gave it a shot, but you're like, I just don't see it. And I think you said you played it for like an hour, and that's fine. And I think you mentioned you went back to playing something you were familiar with. And I'm like, that's it. That's why re-releases work for people, because, you know, it's a point of comfort, let's be honest.
Yeah. And I won't be able to clarify that tweet, because honestly that sums up most of my experiences with a lot of games. Is I'll play it for an hour or so, it won't click, and I'll go back to something I know. Because again, like different people, when this kind of ties in with our Far Cry 6 discussion last week, but like we've all got different amounts of time to play games. It makes sense to play the ones you enjoy, and you know the ones you enjoy. It's no different to rewatching films, rewatching through series, rereading old books. Like, you don't have to play something new every single time. You don't have to play whatever's in the zeitgeist every single time. And these aren't small, quirky, niche releases. You know, Skyrim, GTA 3, Vice City, San Andreas are big, influential titles, particularly GTA 3. I'm at the time of recording, I'm hoping to be work. I'm trying to work on a feature. And if that feature doesn't come together, I'm just going to do my rant here. GTA 3, which I have to confess I didn't play much back in the day because I didn't have a PlayStation 2. I think the closest I came was I had Liberty City Stories on PSP, which isn't quite the same game, but it's close enough. GTA 3, I still look at that. That is the foundation of the open world games that we play now. Like I said, I've just started playing The Witcher 3 on Xbox. And it's like, I know these are all fields rather than a city, but this is the GTA 3 formula. Here's a big sandbox. You can go wherever you want to, do whatever you want, but if you want to progress, you have to go to this specific point, talk to a person, it triggers a cutscene, and that triggers a scripted mission. And that's what GTA 3 did back in 2001, and we are still working on that formula. It's not, I'd say, like, you know, Breath of the Wild is perhaps the next step forward in terms of it's a very systems driven, it's very much about kind of organic discovery. There's not a lot of go to this person, do a quest, go back and collect the quest. There's not as much of that. It's more about exploring the world and experimenting with the systems in it. But GTA 3 created this formula, and you look at, you know, all Ubisoft open world games, the Saints Row series, obviously, perhaps like the Just Cause, like the vast majority of open worlds are still building in some way on that formula. So to have that being re-released, like, obviously it's great for people who missed, you know, who enjoyed it back in the day and want to give it another go, want to revisit it, and particularly now it's got a very nice shiny coat of paint. But it's also interesting, like, for gamers who, you know, players who are interested in, like, where all this comes from. You can go back and see the origins, as it were. Like, it's similar to if you go back and play, like, earlier versions of Nintendo titles, you can see, I can see the route from that one to what I've been playing recently.
Yeah, it's, like you said, it's interesting where 3 in particular, it really did, I don't know if the words culture shift it really fits, but it definitely set that template where, and I don't know if y'all remember just how big and popular it was. Well, the apex of that popularity, I still remember it, where it got to a point where, you know, my mom would come back from work, and then she said, "Hey, is this the game that I bought for you? That's violent." Granted, we really couldn't hide it was violent from her, but eventually she found out. She's like, "Oh, okay. Well, as long as you're not doing what the news said." But anyway, yeah, it especially now we're almost 20 years removed from when it originally released, and just to see those same systems and that DNA is literally a part of so many games today and so many franchises, because it really did set the template. Like, you're this guy, you can build a criminal empire and you can do all these things, and other games have, you know, taken that idea of the sandbox and just applied different, you know, ideologies to it. Not so much crime, it could just be adventure or magic or what have you. But yeah, it's interesting at that point. And while we're talking about GTA, I don't want to forget that within the collection, me personally, I just like to see how people are going to look at 3 and then Vice City over time, you know, with how it presented its story. You know, how are things still, do they still click the same? You know what I mean? That's like I said, that's really fascinating to me, to see people like revisit something that they probably played either when they were, I guess, really little or in their late teens or what have you. It's interesting to see that. And because Marie asked us to say this, I don't want to forget to say that she thinks Vice City has the best music out among the three. So I want to make sure we say that on the pod. Me personally, I'm really interested in Vice City because, you know, being a Miami native, it was the first time I think Miami was set in a video game of that size. Obviously, since then, it's been commonplace. But that was really cool to see that, you know, when I was younger. So it's interesting to revisit that to see what happens. But yeah, it this all goes back to what we were saying earlier, that there's comfort in people playing things they're familiar with, even though the graphics may be bumped up a little bit. You're on new hardware now where you have a nicer TV, you have better audio. Yeah, and re-releases selling is not really rocket science when you think about it like that.
I believe Miami was like the opening level of Driver back on the PlayStation and the PC, because I spent a lot of time in that game, but the world was nowhere near it. I know what you mean. Like, it as much as they said it was Miami, it was just a very large network of square roads and corners. And, you know, it didn't feel like Miami the way that Vice City did. Vice City kind of captured more of an atmosphere of a place than Driver did. But yeah, no, I can imagine that. I always remember back in the day, like when GTA 3 came out, and then like a lot of other people were trying doing these open worlds, and you had like open worlds set in you know, fictional cities, but then also like one set in like real cities. So you had like The Getaway was set in London. I remember thinking like, oh, I wish I could have a GTA Chelmsford. I'd like to just drive around my town and see what chaos I can cause. But yeah, that's not happened since. I don't think Chelmsford is the Essex in general is not the sexiest setting for a video game.
Yeah, I keep waiting for a game in Toronto. I don't think it's going to happen.
That's surprising, given the development scene up there. I mean, like, you know, it's easy location scouting because you just walk to work. I'm surprised there is not more games set in like Toronto or Montreal. Maybe the people who work in Montreal and Toronto are just so sick of the city they just want to make fantastical places as a means of escapism.
Well, maybe we'll get like Assassin's Creed, Black Flag, or Unity. One of those was technically set in Montreal. So the development scene in the real world in a game developer's office, all that was in Montreal. So you'd go up to the executive penthouse or whatever, and then you'd see a really impressive rendering of the Montreal skyline. I could see Toronto getting something like that. You know, aim high, keep your hopes, keep reaching for the stars. Yeah. I love Toronto, but I've got no illusions about everyone else's interest in Toronto.
That's kind of how I feel about Miami, especially when I see it depicted in films and games. And I'm like, okay, so are you not going to pass two blocks past this area? It's always the same. Like, if you watch, I'm sorry, I'm going on a tangent, but if you watch Bad Boys in particular, there's like that club area. Obviously, the films do go to other places, but it's like that's what you see in Vice City, in these other games that depict Miami. But it's like literally two blocks away from there. They never seem to pass that, and it's always like frustrating to me. It's like, okay, that's a creative choice. I understand, but anyway,
yeah, I love the geography of real world cities in movies and games. When you like, I lived in San Francisco for a while, so I watch Venom, and there's a car chase scene, and it's like you've been circling the same block for 5 minutes here. What the heck? And then you watch like Bullet, and it's like all of a sudden you have just made one cut and you are now like 3 miles south of the city. Oh, now you're right back at Lombard Street. What is happening here?
My favorite is, at the risk of the inevitable James Bond reference, my favorite is it's View to a Kill, the fire truck chase in View to a Kill. That's in San Francisco, and there's like a clip of them driving along Market Street, and there's something about the angle you can quite clearly tell they're driving west along Market Street, and then it cuts, and the very next scene is about like 20 miles away driving east, because you can see that giant pyramid style building in the distance. Like, how did that happen? How? What happened in the intermitting bit that we just did not get? Oh, dear.
That's fun stuff. Getting back to games, though, I do think that right now, especially, old games and re-releases are probably, I suspect that they are enjoying better fortunes than they would otherwise, just because the last year and a half has kind of had us all, I think, probably more inclined for some comfort gaming. Just, you know, that warm security blanket of something that we know and like and you know, feels safe and comfortable and familiar, because day-to-day life has been less so.
I'm not gonna lie. I want to know. I know what I thought when I was 16 playing Grand Theft Auto 3. I would like to know what I think now as an adult after just going through life experiences. And I'm thinking like, huh, oh, that's a problem. Why didn't I see?
I do wonder that. Like, given the scrutiny that's on GTA 5 at the moment for the transphobia, for a start, like the references that people are campaigning to remove, I'm surprised we haven't seen more about like the original GTA trilogy. Yeah, that PS2 era GTA trilogy is like, there must have been stuff in there that was beyond questionable, because that was when it was being almost cartoonish in how they say it's difficult, but like it was that going for that, you know, anything's up for grabs in terms of comedy. So yeah, I mean, I'm intrigued to see how well they stand up today in terms of cultural references. I'm going to start winding us down. Obviously, we've been talking about the same sort of games that get re-released a lot. Skyrim has been re-released a lot. GTA, the trilogy, has been re-released a fair amount, maybe not as much as Skyrim. Nintendo's back catalogue is constantly on a cycle of being re-released. Are there any games that we think deserve another re-release that you'd like to see on current generation of consoles or PC or mobile or whatever, current devices? Is there anything you think deserves a re-release, either in the style of GTA, where it's got a bit of a lick of paint, or in the style of Skyrim, where it is pretty much the same game?
Sleeping Dogs.
Marvel vs. Capcom 2.
Marvel vs. Capcom 2. We understood
that assignment. Yeah, I'm always going to say that. Sleeping Dogs is one that I think a lot of people would probably appreciate if they got a chance to, like, an excuse to pick it up for the first time again, because it has, I think its reputation has grown over the years. And the other one I'd say is ZHP, Unlosing Ranger versus Dark Death Evil Man, which is a personal favorite, and actually is getting a re-release on Switch next year, so everyone should play that. But yes, sorry, Sleeping Dogs?
Yeah, I was ready to launch in with that, because I'm replaying it at the minute, and I think you're right. I think at the time, it didn't really feel like it got the attention it deserved, but has become somewhat of a sort of like a cult classic. I don't know if I can call it that, but people, like you said, people do seem to like it more, and there is a little bit more talk around it. And it's the 10th anniversary next year, so I'll be keeping an eye out on anything Sleeping Dogs related.
Jeffrey, are they still making the movie with Donnie Yen?
I have no idea.
I feel like, are they still making insert video game movie here, is the question you can ask about any video game movie.
It's fair.
Jeffrey, go on.
For myself, when I think about this question, I only have one answer, and that's Parasite Eve. And if you don't know what that is, it's just really, really quick, is that over the course of a weekend around Christmas, a New York detective like weird shit happens where people are turning into monsters, whatever. It's like a horror game, and she also discovers that she has like superpowers. It's this old Square Enix RPG that came out around 2000. It honestly, if they did a full remake or even just tried to do the rest, but I think it would still resonate because it has horror RPG mechanics and a female protagonist who is it's really good and it's really creepy. That's all I can say. More Parasite Eve.
Nice. For me, I feel like the obvious answer would be Thief Gold and Thief 2 brought to level, like Dishonored levels of quality. But the one that surprises me is that they didn't re-release Deus Ex. They didn't remaster Deus Ex. Like, particularly given that, I know Mankind Divided didn't do well enough to warrant Square Enix making more of it. They put the entire franchise on hold. But Human Revolution was really well received. So, like, some sort of revisit to the original game. Like, I'm shocked that that hasn't happened. Because that, again, that was a proper kind of a seminal moment in games. That's a really kind of acclaimed title that a lot of people have fond memories of. A lot of people kind of point to as the root of certain design ethoses and feature designs. And yeah, shocked that Deus Ex has not come out again.
Klonoa, Tomba, Mars Matrix. That's a great 2D shoot 'em up if anyone is in the market for that. There's, like, this is kind of my thing lately, is that there's just so many great games that are prisoner to their old abandoned platforms, and they are preserved through piracy. So, you know, thank you for that, video game industry, for making sure that pirates are the only people that are really actually keeping this stuff accessible in any way, shape, or form going forward. I don't actually, you know, pirate stuff, and it's a hassle. I want convenience, you know. I want company. I will pay you again for this stuff, just give me the option of it.
I just want to play Klonoa or Cooler World without paying £80 for it from someone on eBay.
And it's getting worse too during the pandemic. Again, everyone with the NFT craze is also like, you know, hey, let's scoop up some old video games, and oh, this one's in a box and we had it graded, so now let's put it in auction for $1 million and everything. Like, there's just so many completely speculative, kind of senseless investments being made that are blowing up in the last year or two. It's like once I started, like, you know, opening my eyes and looking for them, I was seeing so many places where it's just like, hey, that's weird, that probably shouldn't be happening. Oh, look, that too.
I feel like we're on the verge of entering a whole other wormhole of conversation, so I think we'll wrap it up there. That is all we have got time for. Thank you so much to my team for joining me and for enduring what is now the last attempt at a small talk intro. You can find all previous episodes of the GamesIndustry.biz podcast on the podcasting platform of your choice, and you can get more news, insight, and analysis into the world behind video games at GamesIndustry.biz.